Good evening and welcome. This is, not sure which one this is, but it is a sharper focus, wider lens. I'm not sure if it's the third or the fourth, but this is our presentation today is going to be Food and the City. We've got four very distinguished MSU panelists. I'll introduce them one at a time. They'll each give their presentation, and then one will go after the other. We'll have a little bit of time for the panelists to react to the other panelists, and then we'll open it up to the audience. So with that, again, welcome on behalf of the Dean of the Honors College, and we'll start off on the end with Dr. Helen Veit. She's an assistant professor in the Department of History, specializing in the history of the United States in the 19th and 20th centuries. She focuses on the history of food and nutrition. Her first book, Modern Food, Moral Food, Self-Control, Science, and the Rise of Modern American Eating in the Early 20th Century, is coming out this summer. It explores food and nutrition in the progressive era and their relationship to self-discipline, scientific rationalization, and international power. Dr. Veit is also the editor of the American Food and History book series, forthcoming from MSU Press. So with that, will you join me in welcoming Dr. Veit?
Hi there. Thank you very much for coming out tonight. And thank you, John Beck and others, for organizing all of this. Please let me know if you can't hear me at any point. I'll lean in or speak more loudly. I'm going to give a little bit of historical context. I'm a history professor. And I think it's important to understand a little bit about the history of food, precisely because so many people are talking about it, even if they're not thinking of it in that way. Today, popular interest in food has never been higher. The last few decades have seen a renewed interest in the pleasures of cooking food, growing it, eating it, and a broad range of Americans has become invested in knowing where their food comes from. Driven by concerns ranging from taste to food safety to environmental degradation. Participation in farmers markets and farm shares has boomed, and demand for organic and local products, even in regular supermarkets, has exploded recently. And in many cities, of course, urban agriculture is flourishing. Food reform today comes in a lot of different forms. But one thing that reformers usually share is an understanding that food was different and better in the past. For example, the food journalist Michael Pollan, who you might know, he's the author of books like The Omnivore's Dilemma, has famously said, don't eat anything that your great-great-grandmother wouldn't recognize as food. In other words, no Cheetos. Modern food reformers also routinely make use of sort of old-fashioned rural aesthetic that implies a great divide between rural food, which is usually shorthand for traditional, natural, pastoral, simple, and urban food, which in the rhetoric becomes shorthand for modern, unnatural, complicated, environmentally taxing. This understanding of urban versus rural food is a pretty romantic one, which is to say that it's a pretty inaccurate one. Even our great-great-grandparents were usually far afield from the food fantasies of today's most ardent locavores. For example, if your great-grandparents were living in the US, their pantries were probably full of things like refined sugar, industrially milled flours, spices like cinnamon, products like tapioca, and they probably sometimes even ate imported fruit like bananas or pineapple. They included a range of ingredients that had been imported across the globe. When food enthusiasts today eagerly take up things like home canning or home cheese making, home brewing, they're doing things that their great grandparents themselves would have been delighted to outsource. This is not to say that farming and cooking and eating in the past weren't better in some ways, because they certainly were. But the story of modern food is more complicated than a simple fall from grace. Tonight, I want to offer a very brief snapshot of food roughly 100 years ago. This is a picture of an early canned food. The early 20th century was an important time in the history of American food because it was when rapid urbanization coincided with high rates of immigration and the rise of industrial food, all of which profoundly shaped modern American food. The U.S. officially became more urban than rural starting in 1920. What that means is that for the first time ever, more Americans were living in urban places. Rural, by this definition, meant just 2,500 people, so it could be what seems to us like a really small town. But that was a very important distinction. It meant that for the first time, fewer Americans than not, more Americans than not, were no longer living on farms. But that doesn't mean that they weren't farming. Americans living in urban areas routinely supplemented their diets with food that they grew themselves. In vegetable gardens, for example, which were common throughout the early 20th century up through the 1920s in cities. Urban agriculture also included things like livestock keeping, chickens, pigs, also cows. Food distribution networks favored cities from the beginning. Imported foods like bananas and pineapples, which I mentioned earlier, went through urban ports first, and city dwellers had the first and the freshest pick. In fact, many imported foods never made it to rural areas in the first place. Perhaps more surprisingly, cities were the hubs of domestic food networks too. Refrigerated rail cars, in other words, trains, whole cars of which were refrigerated, started becoming in regular use by the 1880s. And this made it possible for the first time to ship produce across the country. So in other words, refrigeration plus transport equaled a national market for fresh produce. And the market made possible the explosion of things like California agriculture. This is California asparagus. Commodities like iceberg lettuce were actually specifically designed with national refrigeration transportation in mind. Iceberg is so bland and so indestructible precisely because it was designed to withstand a cross-country voyage in, you know, a bed of ice on a train. Meanwhile, the growth of national grocery chains also gave Americans unprecedented access to a variety of foods year-round. So both the national market for produce and the rise of national grocery chains can obscure the fact that this was not equally available across the nation. So in other words, it seems counterintuitive, but 100 years ago, it was becoming easier to find fresh fruits and vegetables in cities than it was in rural places. Industrially processed food was also more readily available in cities than in rural areas. And today that might seem unimpressive to us because to us, processed food means high fat, highly processed, not good for you. Back then, that's not really how Americans thought of processed foods. They celebrated them not just for the convenience and the freedom it offers cooks, which we still do to some extent, but also for the variety of foods and tastes and also nutrition, the different kinds of vitamins you could suddenly have all year round, even in northern areas. Correspondingly, where today an industrial food company usually goes out of its way to put pastoral, rural imagery on its products, 100 years ago, food companies were much more likely to advertise the fact that their products were scientific. They were the product of machines. They hadn't been touched by human hands. They were clean. They were hygienic, et cetera. This was especially true in the wake of the Pure Food and Drug Act of 1906, as industrial food really did start to stand for safety and consistency and hygiene. And this was meaningful. Before then, milk, for example, had routinely caused outbreaks of diseases, of communicable diseases, or it had simply been spoiled. Canned food had been unreliably processed so that it was often spoiled inside. By the early 1920s, the basic structure of America's modern food industry was in place, and it was growing rapidly. And it included many of the brands that we're familiar with today, from Heinz, Nabisco, Sunkist, Dole, Quaker Oats, Pepsi, Coke, you know, and many, many more were already in place 100 years ago. I think it's interesting that urbanization affected not just what foods people could buy and where they went, it also affected how much people ate. And that was because the rise of urbanization led to a sedentary, white-collar, middle-class workforce. And this meant rapidly declining calorie intakes, or at least rapidly declining calorie needs. And people talked about this all the time. And in calorie studies, which were just becoming popular at this time, it showed that, yes, Americans are, in fact, eating less than they used to. One of the ways that this made a really big change in our culture, a change that is still with us today, is that in the 19th century, Americans routinely ate really big breakfast. Breakfast to them were hot meals. They were almost indistinguishable from other meals. They usually included hot breads, beef, fish, beans, for people who could afford it, vegetables, all sorts of things that today we don't think of as breakfast foods. By the 1920s, thanks in part to industrially processed cereals, breakfast had become a very new and very unique, historically unprecedented thing, centered around toast and cold cereal. Of course, the culinary benefits of urbanization only accrued to those people who could afford them. Throughout the 19th and early 20th centuries, the American urban poor had scanty access to milk, fresh fruits and vegetables, meats, and dietary shortfalls were worsened by skyrocketing food prices. Food prices were just escalating like crazy in the early 20th century. And there were food riots throughout the era. In New York, for example, a caseworker on the East Side recorded stories of desperately poor Jewish families subsisting almost entirely on bread and coffee. This is a famous image you might know from Jacob Riis, who did How the Other Half Lives. Poverty was particularly acute, in fact, among recent immigrants who had entered the country in record numbers around the turn of the century. By 1910, more than a third of the U.S. population had been born outside U.S. borders, more than a third. To people who were white, native-born Americans, this alarmed people that so many immigrants had come in, and they started an Americanization campaign to try to get immigrants to adopt so-called American customs and habits. Food was very much among them. However, reformers, as they tried to convince immigrants to eat what they considered the model American meal, things like plain meat, plain bread, a vegetable on the side, ran headlong into immigrants' own ideas about food, which were often very different. In fact, historians have found that when they didn't go along with Americanization in this regard, it was mainly just because they thought their own food was better. Instead, subconsciously foreign foods were becoming an increasingly important part of mainstream American diets themselves, and an important vehicle for foreign foods, not only the industrial food chain — a lot of these were increasingly available in canned form, like Heinz canned spaghetti — but also foreign restaurants, which were increasingly common in cities. Foreign restaurants and urban street vendors helped to make foreign foods, from spaghetti to chili to pretzels, things that were not only increasingly prominent in American diets, but decreasingly foreign. This is a pretzel vendor in the early 20th century. Today, few people think of pretzels as something that is foreign at all. So this was a very brief sprint through the history of food in the city, just a tiny snapshot, as I said. I hope it whets your appetite for more, because I do think that having a somewhat more nuanced picture of food in the past can help us direct food in the future in what I hope are truly sustainable directions. So thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Veit. Next, we're pleased to welcome Dr. Michael Hamm. He is the C.S. Mott Professor of Sustainable Agriculture at MSU. He's currently affiliated with the Departments of Community, Agriculture, Recreation, and Resource Studies, Plant, Soil, and Microbial Sciences, and Food Science and Human Nutrition. Dr. Hamm was co-founder and director of the New Jersey Urban Ecology Program and the founding director of the Cook Student Organic Farm. At MSU, he is director of the Center for Regional Food Systems, which engages the people of Michigan, the U.S., and the world in applied research, education, and outreach to develop regionally integrated sustainable food systems. Community food security, community and sustainable food systems are active research areas for Dr. Hamm. He is a member of the governor-appointed Michigan Food Policy Council. So, Dr. Hamm.
Thank you very much. And thank you to the organizers, John, and everybody else for this. It's a marvelous evening. And it will spring will come, and it will get warm. And this is my Hope Springs Eternal tie that I always use in the spring. But those of you who know anything about farming know that the cherry growers and the apple growers and the peach growers are ecstatic that winter is not ending too soon or ending abruptly and then coming back again, which is what happened last year when we lost all of our crop. So I just want to take a few minutes to talk about, to kind of switch gears a little bit and talk about two things. First of all, some global trends that give us pause and let us think about why we're focused on regional food systems in our center and a lot of work we do with people here in Michigan and across the country. And to talk about some things that are happening in the urban areas with respect to urban agriculture. So first of all, a few statistics that probably most of you are aware of, but I want to put a context on it with respect to our food supply. You all probably know that right now we have somewhere under 310 million people in this country, and projections are by 2050 we'll have 420 million. So we'll add about 100 million people to the domestic population, and the world will add about 2 billion to the world. And that should be kept in context that right now there's about 48 countries in the world that are water stressed or water scarce, which means there's insufficient fresh water supplies for their current population, and all those countries have growing populations. We'll add about 6 more countries to that list in the next 30 or 40 years. Parts of the U.S. today, the Southwest, parts of the Midwest last summer when we had a severe drought here in Michigan and across the Midwest, parts of the West Coast, are also water-stressed or water-scarce. In other words, there's insufficient water supplies for the population in those parts of the country, and typically that's balanced by shipping water in. The other thing to keep track of is that little state on the West Coast called California produces about 50% of the domestic fruits and vegetables in the United States today. So while every year we import more fruits and vegetables from non-domestic, from offshore sources, half of what's produced in the country today is coming from California. And here's the situation in California over the next 30 or 40 years. Right now they've got about 36 million people. They'll add another 14 million. They'll grow to about 50 million people by 2050. Climate change scenarios say that the snowpack runoff in the mountains could decline by as much as 70% over that period of time. There'll still probably be about the same amount of rainfall, but it'll come down as rain instead of snow. And think about the ramifications of what that means. When it comes down as rain in the wintertime, it's not stored in the mountains as snowpack and runs off in the late spring, early summer, but rather it runs off fairly rapidly. And what that means is that effectively, there's not water stored in the mountains to come off at the times when farms need it for irrigation. So without a lot of damming of those water supplies up in the mountains, probably what's going to happen by 2050 is that water's going to come off those mountains at a time when it's not needed, and it's not going to be there at a time when it is needed. So if you put together an increase of 14 million people who need places to live, roads to move on, places to recreate, places to work, and they need water, and we'll probably have less fresh water in the summer times coming out of the mountains, what that means is agriculture will probably suffer. There will be less land in agriculture in California. There will be less water for the agriculture that is there, which means there's a high degree of likelihood that in 2050, California will not be producing 50% of our domestic produce. And what that means is that there's an opportunity for places like Michigan, which has both a lot of water. We're surrounded by 18% of the world's fresh water. We have good soils. We have good climate. And we have a large farming population and an ag experiment station and a College of Agriculture here at Michigan State that knows how to grow and produce a large variety of fruits and vegetables. So we have the infrastructure. The other part to keep in mind about all this, which ties in with the development in California, is that across the country, about 90% of the land that grows fruits, tree nuts, and berries today is on land that's in the path of development, about 78% of our vegetables and melons, which means that not just in California, but across the country, if we do nothing over the next 30 or 40 years to protect some of our landscape for food production, we in fact may have difficulties producing that food down the road. And the final thing to keep track of before we move forward and talk about other things, about more optimistic things, the other thing to keep track of is that right now, the average American eats about half the fruits and vegetables that they should. So to put that in perspective, if everybody woke up tomorrow and said, you know, I'm going to do what public health experts think I'm going to eat twice as many fruits and vegetables. Well, the first thing that happens is that all the nutritionists at MSU would faint. Mm-hmm. The second thing that would happen is the produce shelves would be empty. And the third thing that would happen is we'd find out that we're about 18 million acres short of production. 18 million acres is 2 to 3 Californias. And there's not 2 to 3 Californias left in the United States. So what that means is there's opportunity to think about redistributing production of fruits and vegetables across the country. And while we had all that refrigeration in, as early as the 1880s that was shipping stuff in, and in New York City there was West Coast apples coming in even when the Hudson Valley was flush with apples, what it means is, but at that point in time, we still had a fairly robust regional production of a lot of fruits and vegetables. So if you look at agricultural statistics for most counties in the United States back in the 40s, you'll find that their production was more diverse than it is today, which means we have the environmental portfolio across the country to grow a much greater variety in many parts of the country than we do today, especially in places like Michigan. And it's about infrastructure, it's about skill, it's about setting up policies and regulations that allow that to happen more easily. That's the stumbling block right now. So in urban areas, what we think about is producing food in four different ways. So an urban food supply can either come from internally or it can come from outside that area and shipped in. And the reality is with the rise of urban agriculture, both of those things are happening. Now the reality is a lot of us, we hear about Detroit. Detroit's certainly a big hotbed of urban agriculture right now. And the thing we have to remember is that in the range and the continuum of cities' ability to grow their own food if they desired, Detroit's at one end of the spectrum. And a place like Manhattan, New York City is probably at the other end of the spectrum because of population density relative to land availability. Detroit is out there with places like Cleveland and Toledo and Milwaukee and a lot of the kind of Rust Belt and Auto Belt cities of the Midwest that are depopulating in the urban areas. And so there's a lot of open space opening up. Other places, especially on the two coasts, in fact, just the opposite is happening. Those places are becoming more dense. But in those areas, we can think of growing food outdoors, in high tunnels, in greenhouses, or inside buildings and vertical agriculture structures. And all those things are in the popular press today. And so the point that I kind of want to press home today is that in a hierarchy of environmental sustainability, first of all, there's a lot of unknowns because a lot of the things that are promulgated in the popular press and we see in the newspapers and everything, in fact, have never been researched from a standpoint of their environmental sustainability. What's the carbon footprint of building those structures and growing food in those structures relative to the ability of that food to capture CO2 from the environment? And so if we look at things like high tunnels, which we have here in profusion at MSU in the Student Organic Farm, we've had a lot of research here over the years by John Birnbaum and other people in horticulture looking at how to produce these foods in structures that look like greenhouses as you drive by them, but where there is no external heat, there's no fossil fuel being used to heat those. They're only being heated by sunlight and by tricks of technology. But you can grow 30 different crops in January inside those high tunnels. And in fact, we ate at Brody today, and there were greens in the salad bar that were produced in the 30 by 144 foot high tunnel out at the student farm. And they were delicious. And in fact, if we look at the environmental sustainability of those in a place like Michigan, they're probably fairly sustainable. So this is a study that was done, a life cycle analysis, done by an undergraduate working with me for the last 2 years named Rachel Plawecki. And it looks at the carbon emissions of growing lettuce in one of these hoop houses in Michigan versus growing it in California and shipping it to Michigan. And what you see is that the carbon footprint, in fact, is about one-fifth in the Michigan-grown versus the California-grown. The caveat to that is if you as a consumer drive 15 or more miles to that farm just to pick up 1 kilo of lettuce and then drive home, you've wiped out that benefit. The CO2 you emit in the car just to get that 1 kilo of lettuce, you wipe out the benefit. So how we circulate internally is important too. But the point of it is that we can do season extension in ways that are more sustainable than getting that food from distant sources. Now the other side of the coin is there's other things we can do too of growing these things indoors in heated greenhouses. So we add another layer of complexity of using fossil fuel energy and supplementing with light in the wintertime when there's not enough sunlight. So these are pictures all from the Netherlands, where a trip that Chris and I took to visit a number of greenhouses. This is an industrial scale research greenhouse, actually. And what you can see basically is a well-articulated system that they've developed for producing tomatoes year-round and flying them in and shipping them into the United States and other places. And again, because we're now adding fossil fuel energy and we're adding supplemental light, which uses electricity, in this case LED lights, whether or not there's a carbon footprint that balances in that kind of a system with all that extra added energy is up for grabs. We haven't done that research yet. I haven't seen it. Economically, you can make it make sense if you charge enough. Environmentally, that's up for grabs. The final type that's being promulgated up there, and where there's a lot of entrepreneurs that are going at this, is complete indoor systems using red and blue LED lights. Why just red and blue? That's what the chloroplast of the plant absorbs. They don't absorb, the reason the plant's green is because they're reflecting the green wavelengths. And so you only, to save energy, you only use the wavelengths that the chloroplast is absorbing, which is red and blue. So inside those things, the plant looks gray. It's actually kind of strange. If it's in there, it's gray. You pull it out in the hallway, it's green. You put it back in, it's gray. So it changes right before your eyes. And so these are systems where the sunlight is basically ignored. It's all produced with LED lighting in an enclosed system. And again, where we're not using the solar energy, whether or not that can be done in an environmentally sustainable way or not is up for grabs. So the point of those four things is that there's multiple ways that we can think about growing food in and for cities with a population rising by 2 billion worldwide and a global and an urbanizing environment that I know our next couple speakers will talk about, and how we do that in a sustainable manner from a standpoint not just of economic and social but also of environmental remains up for grabs. And with that, I'll end and just say this is my grandmother and my daughter. My grandmother is now 105. My daughter turns 15. With 90 years difference, the main difference sometimes between the two is with one you can have a beer and with the other you can't. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Rearranging cords here, excuse us. Okay, thank you. Our next speaker is Dr. Christopher Peterson. He is the Homer Nolan Chair of Consumer Responsive Agriculture and Professor of Agricultural, Food, and Resource Economics at MSU. He is the Director of the MSU Product Center for Agriculture and Natural Resources. Dr. Peterson's research and outreach activities span the areas of strategic management, value-added ventures, and differentiated product development, cooperative theory and financial practices, entrepreneurship, business innovation, the emergence of the bioeconomy, vertical coordination strategy, and supply chain management. His work involves programming in Detroit as well as in multiple other metropolitan regions around the world. So welcome, Dr. Peters.
Thank you. Well, a very, very important topic, and one that has become more and more of my career over the last few years. If you go back long ago and far away, I started out on a very small dairy farm in central Pennsylvania, and my dad and mom raised two sons on essentially 25 head of dairy animals. That kind of dairy agriculture doesn't really exist, at least at commercial scale, anymore. And yes, I do remember real sauerkraut being made, and also the realization that you lost a couple of crocks every year because the botulism took it over. And, you know, there are just all sorts of interesting things. Plus, I grew up for 18 years on raw milk, which has become very controversial here in the state of Michigan. And again, it's interesting to think about the food of my youth versus where I am today. A quote by Norman Borlaug, a Nobel laureate, often talked about as the father of the last green revolution here in the world. And the quote goes like this: to feed the growing world population, we will have to produce in the next 40 years the same amount of food that was produced in the last 10,000. Think about it. That's a relatively daunting task when put that way. And I have no doubt that he was very deliberate in putting it that way. So how we're going to feed the cities of the future or any of the population in the future is a very, very important thing. Now, part of why I'm here this evening is because I direct two centers here at Michigan State. The first one is the Product Center, Food Ag Bio, and we like to think of ourselves as the go-to place for venture development assistance and market assessment for all sorts of businesses, both brand new businesses and existing businesses that want to take new products and services to market that are related to food, agriculture, natural resources, and the bioeconomy. We've done everything from gourmet organic pastured poultry for the white tablecloth industry in Chicago at the ultimate niche end of our work to having been heavily involved with the formation of one of the five ethanol plants in the state, and we've done everything in between. One of our most important things that we've done in recent years and over 10 years now, we have seen over 300 ventures successfully launched, but 55 of our clients' products are now going to be on the shelves in a special Made in Michigan section in 102 Meijer stores. And in addition, 25 of our clients' projects will be in 36 Kroger stores here in the state of Michigan. And part of what we had to do was create a local distribution center to be able to get those things to the shelves in the way in which the Meijers and the Krogers of the world need to have that happen. It's an exciting thing to do. It's very exciting to work with small specialty food entrepreneurs, and fully half of our clients have come from the five counties of metropolitan Detroit. And so we have worked already with any number of urban residents who want to take family recipes and the heritage, whatever it may be in their background, and produce specialty foods that go to market for niche and other kinds of high value markets. The other thing I've been working on more recently is the creation of the Global University. And that's an innovation accelerator where we're attempting to create a network of the world's metropolitan regions to develop and share innovations in food, agriculture, and the integrated resource systems of water, land, and energy. And the list of cities is there: Detroit, Hyderabad, a city of 10 million, the Netherlands, an entire country that is in essence a metropolitan region, Nairobi, Johannesburg, Sao Paulo, which is 22 million people, and Singapore, which is a city-state of some 5 million people. You take a look at the diversity of those seven places and you say, what do they have in common? Well, they all have to get food to their populations, and they all have to care about issues of distribution. They have to care about how much of it can be grown in the city, how much of it from around the city, and how much of it really has to be brought in from the rural countryside. In Singapore, they just recently announced that they want to double the internal food production, which will take it from 3% of their needs to 6% of their needs. So imagine living in a city where you're importing almost everything that you eat and all of your fresh water besides. An interesting place, needless to say. Well, I'm going to share three quick stories with you about food in the city. And this first story is really about Detroit, and I'd begin by saying urban gardening needs entrepreneurship to be sustainable. There is an explosion of urban gardening going on in the city of Detroit, and it is very important socially in terms of the ability of relatively low resource individuals to be able to produce some of their own food to add to their healthy diets. We also see the environment of many of otherwise devastated communities being revitalized by the presence of gardens and other sorts of amenities that are related to growing food. And all of these things have great social impact. But we're also in a city that needs to be able to create jobs and create ventures to be able to put the urban population to work. And so that if you focus only on the gardening, you don't necessarily get a long way towards feeding the city. You have to move from the notion of the community garden to a market garden. And in fact, that's where most of these folks are headed. They have the community garden that is for the community's consumption, but then they've got the market garden where the produce goes to Eastern Market a couple of days a week down in Detroit, or it ends up in a place like Colors Restaurant. You want to go to a good place in Detroit, go to Colors Restaurant, because they, in fact, buy a lot of local food to bring into the restaurant, and they also train people to run the kitchen, to be waiters and waitresses, and move into the workforce in addition to everything that they do. And if you have never had a sweet potato wonton, believe me, you've got to go have one there. But it takes entrepreneurship. It takes making a profit to make these things sustainable. Now let me shift to Hyderabad, a city that went from 5 million to 10 million in less than a decade. A city in which the vast majority of those 10 million still buy their produce off of hand carts in the street. And you can never imagine the appetizing nature of meat when you see it hanging there in the open air with no sanitation, and it just makes you wonder. Well, we went to a village about 50 kilometers outside of town, and the farmers there were on the cutting edge. They had stopped growing rice and wheat and other staple crops, and they were converting all of their production to fruits and vegetables for the city. And the government had even been so farsighted as to help build them a cooling and packing shed so that, in fact, they could bring the produce out of the fields, cool it down, prepare it to ship into these dramatically large needs for produce in the city. But along the way, no one seems to have thought about how all of this fresh, chilled, packed produce would make it across 50 kilometers of nearly impassable roads. That's the fundamental struggle in some of these places. And let's go to the Netherlands for my third and final story, and let me pick up where Mike stopped. Photosynthesis, as he says, only needs three wavelengths of light, and now that we have LED technology, we can in fact deliver three and only three wavelengths of light, and we can grow plants in a nutrient medium without soil. We can use 1/10 the water that's necessary in the natural environment to grow those crops. Those crops grow without blemish and disease. They can be grown quicker. And as a matter of fact, in some of the work being done by these companies, there's the discovery that the optimal ratio of light to dark for a plant is 4 hours of light to 1 hour of darkness, which means they can achieve 5 days of growth in one 24-hour period. So yes, there are challenges to know if all in, all out, this makes sense, but there's also many extraordinary things that suggest this is something that has to be looked at. And in that regard, one of those entrepreneurs has suggested that an area 100 meters long, 100 meters wide, and 20 meters high can produce all of the fruits and vegetables needed by a population of 150,000. Imagine the Myers store of the future with that as their cellar, and you will have reduced the food miles to feet, and you will have absolutely fresh produce. Now, I don't believe any of these things alone will do it. We need entrepreneurship, but that alone isn't going to do it. We need innovation in the supply chains. We need science and technology, but none of these things are going to do it alone.
Thank you, Dr. Peterson. Our final speaker then is Dr. David Shirley. He's a professor, international development in the Department of Agricultural, Food, and Resource Economics at MSU, and he's a member of the MSU's Food Security Group. Dr. Shirley works extensively on two broad sets of issues. His research on high-value food crops in Africa has focused on cotton and fresh produce, and an emerging focus of his is on the environmental and human health implications of intensified fresh produce production for rapidly growing African cities. His second main area of focus work focuses on the interface of food crises and food markets. So with that, Dr. Shirley.
Thank you very much. Thank you, everybody, for coming. This is a great showing on a cool, slowly becoming spring evening. Really great presentations and a nice progression in the presentations from the for me, really interesting focus on U.S. food systems and the history of those food systems and how they've evolved towards a little bit, progressively, a little bit more international content, especially with Chris and his work in Hyderabad and the work they're doing in Nairobi. I'm going to focus entirely on developing countries, and I want to do two things here. Mostly what I want to do is give you kind of an overview of the dynamics that are going on in developing Africa and developing Asia now in terms of urbanization and transformation of food systems. And in doing that, I want to give a little bit of a pitch for a major new center on campus, which is the Global Center for Food System Innovation. Just got launched 2 weeks ago on campus, and we're dealing with, this is one of the major themes that we're dealing with, urbanization and food system transformation. And we're looking not just for graduate students, but also undergraduate students with interest in this, to get involved. So in my last slide, I'll just talk very briefly about that and give you a couple email addresses that you could get in touch with us if you'd like. So I want to talk, first of all, about five transformations, kind of the sub-transformations that are involved in any transformation of an overall food system. And then the focus that we're going to have in what we're calling Megatrend 2 in this center, the Global Center, Megatrend 2 on urbanization and food system transformation. And then focus in on the post-farm portion of this and give you a sense of what's going on, stress the commonalities, but also stress the great differences that we see across countries, within a continent, and across continents, and the need to understand the diversity and the heterogeneity that we see within some common trends. Okay. So the five food system transformations, first of all, are urbanization. Every country in the world over the last 100 years has become dramatically more urbanized, okay? Some of them more slowly than others, but every single country in the world is urbanizing, some of them very rapidly. As this happens, there's a diet transformation that I'll talk briefly about. And then there's, you know, changes that need to happen in response to this urbanization, in response to this diet transformation, in the post-farm portion of the food system, which grows extremely rapidly as these transformations take place, in the pre-farm portion of the food system, in other words, how do farmers get their inputs, what types of inputs do they get, what do they produce, what kind of services do they provide themselves on the farm, and what kind of services do they buy from outside, so the pre-farm portion of it, and then the farm technology, the farm level changes. So in the work in the center, we're going to be focusing, at least in the group that I lead, we're going to be focusing primarily on those first three, okay? So what are the dynamics going on? This figure has data, although those first two boxes, the percentage growth rates there are for sub-Saharan Africa. We've got two things going on. First is rapid urbanization. Cities on average in sub-Saharan Africa are growing about 3% a year, compared to 1% rural growth. So this is explosive growth in cities, 3% a year. In the meantime, Africa, which for many years after independence was not growing at all, is seeing 5% per capita growth in incomes since 2000, okay? Extremely rapid growth. It's not just Asia that's growing rapidly now. Africa is also growing rapidly and looks to be able to continue to do that. So you take urbanization, rapid growth of cities, you take growth of income, which, by the way, is primarily focused in those cities, and you get transformations in dietary patterns. So first of all, consumers are demanding different types of food. They have transformed patterns of demand. There's going to be a lot more demand for perishable items. Meat consumption is going to go up very rapidly. Dairy consumption is going to go up rapidly. Fresh produce production or consumption, we think, will also go up quite rapidly. So more perishable foods, which put a lot of demands on food systems, which the U.S. system is able to deal with, a lot of these developing country systems are much less able to deal with. There's going to be much more demand for processed foods, okay? This includes simple things like maize meal and wheat flour, but it also includes, you know, the famous Cheetos and the Doritos and so forth, with everything that that implies. I'll speak briefly to that. And consumers, as they become more urbanized, as they value their time more, as they become more educated, as they get higher incomes, they're going to be demanding better quality, better packaging, more storage, including cold storage, and much more food safety. Consumers at this point in the poorest countries of Africa and Asia don't spend a lot of time thinking about food safety. Here in the U.S. and in Europe, we spend a lot of time thinking about food safety, but it's going to emerge as a concern over time there as well. So all these transformations just have major implications for vastly increased needs for private investment, which has been woefully inadequate so far in these systems, but also for a lot of public investment, which has also been woefully inadequate. Okay, so public and private investment policy, and for the way in which public and private sectors work together, they need to do it in a much more interactive and collaborative partnership model. And the last bullet there about how to avoid the nutrition transition, the reference I made to the Cheetos and Doritos, we're doing, one of the things we're doing is a study for the World Food Program of the impacts of their purchasing locally food for distribution as food aid, okay? And some of the things that they purchase are called high energy protein supplements. So it's maize mixed with soybeans with added nutrients and so forth that provide a lot of nutrients for people affected by drought and so forth that need high energy and need these micronutrients. But they don't only produce that for World Food Program. When they're not producing that for World Food Program, what are they producing? They're producing puffed corn that's full of oil and full of salt. So they're basically producing kind of fat and salt bombs, and that's in the future where they're going to be making, frankly, most of their money, contributing to this nutrition transition where the problem goes from too few calories, underweight, starvation, to too many calories, too little nutrition, obesity, diabetes, heart disease, and that type of thing, which we see already starting in urban Asia. We see it starting in urban Africa as well. Okay. There are also going to be vastly increased levels of market demand. When you have cities growing at 3% a year, when you have rural areas growing at only 1%, you're going to have relatively many fewer rural households needing to feed many more urban households. So over the next 30 years, more or less, in developing Asia and Africa, the ratio of rural population to urban population is going to fall by half. There's going to be half as many rural people for every urban person 30 years from now in rural in developing Asia and Africa, with obvious implications for the level of productivity that has to be achieved by those rural people. Okay. And demand is going to increase about double every 12 to 14 years. An anecdote that I have is the wholesale market in Nairobi, where Chris is starting some work. The only wholesale market in Nairobi was constructed in 1967, Wakulima Market. It has never been expanded. In the meantime, the city has increased by about five. Incomes have gone up. Your volumes going into the city have exploded. So you've had this mass congestion in that market and other markets that have just sprung up informally and chaotically. And unfortunately, that's the norm in many, many countries. And it's going to get worse unless these types of investments take place. Okay. So this urbanization and the income, the increased per capita income growth in driving these transformations leads to the need for transformations in these post-farm distribution channels, pre-farm distribution channels, and at the farm level. Okay, so there are many commonalities. These are kind of the big patterns that we see going on, and they are going on in a very robust way in all of these countries. But there are also lots of differences in the starting point and lots of differences in the rates at which it's happening. And this is one of the fascinating things, I think, in the terms of the research that we'll be able to do in the center, is really understanding this diversity and heterogeneity, because it really matters for the types of policy and programmatic and investment recommendations that you need to make. Just quickly here, just to give you a sense for how these things differ. This shows urban populations and projections to 2050 in sub-Saharan Africa, Asia, and Central America. And you see that's Central America and Southeastern Asia and sub-Saharan Africa starting off back in the 50s at fairly comparable levels. You've seen vastly different growth rates up to now, with Central America lagging behind, and you have projections for even vastly greater differences through 2050. Okay. So then, if we look within Africa, we see that, for example, despite Africa having very high growth rates, we see that Southern Africa, for example, looks very much like Central America. Okay, so you've got areas of Africa that have just exploding urban populations, and you have areas of Africa that have much more slowly growing populations. All of this matters to what's going on. If we look at these areas here, sub-Saharan Africa and Southern Asia and Southeastern Asia, and we fast forward 40 years, this goes from 2010 to 2050. They're not even going to be at the urban population share levels that Central America is today. So the share of the population that's in urban areas today in Central America is higher than it's going to be in these other areas of the world even in 40 years. So despite this common trend towards urbanization, there are still massive differences, okay? So these places do not look and aren't going to look like Central America for some time. Let's look at income. I referred to that earlier. And the changes in Africa. Among the top 20 most rapidly growing countries in developing Africa and Asia right now, 7 are in sub-Saharan Africa, which wouldn't have been the case some time ago. But at the same time, the 14 poorest countries in the world are also in sub-Saharan Africa. So you have very rapid growing countries, but from very low levels as well. Okay? And just to give you an example of the gap, for incomes in Africa, to meet the level of the poorest countries in Latin America today, okay, they'll have to grow at 6% a year for 30 years. Very high income growth for 30 years just to get to the level of the poorest countries in Latin America today. So the upshot is that we have these very robust dynamics going on all over the world, per capita income growth, urbanization driving very common changes in the patterns of demand, in the levels of demand, driving very common needs for investment by the public and private sector, but vast differences within those common trends, okay? And that's one of the challenges then of this Global Center for Food System Information, is to understand these patterns in a very disaggregated way, and to be able to come up with innovations and policy and programmatic recommendations for our development agencies and for the governments in these countries to take care to deal with these issues. So if you're interested in these types of things, please ask me later about the Translational Scholar Corps. This is my last slide, about the Translational Scholar Corps, which is part of the Global Center. And you could either contact me at that email or Tom Smith or Professor John Dirks in education. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm an engineering faculty here, and each time I go to these, I think, oh, I could study this. I am fascinated by all this. So before we open it up to your questions, I'd like to throw this to the panel and ask any one of you if you heard something that you'd like to go back to one of the panelists about. They're looking at each other. I think most of them, they're good friends. So come on, is there anything?
I should have written them down. I know I had some questions as people were speaking.
I'm sitting here. I have to admit, I wrote the word botulism and food disease, so I'm a home canner, and I like to grow my vegetables and my fruit. I didn't hear anybody really talk, though, too much about technology and food disease. So some of the reasons we do some of what we do with food has to do with preventing disease and not dying from it.
Yes.
So let me just throw that up there.
Okay. The food safety aspect
food
of it?
Food safety,
Go ahead, David.
Well, I would just say, yeah, it's a major issue. And, you know, one of the problems in developing Africa, certainly, and I think developing Asia, although I'm more familiar with Africa, is aflatoxin, which you get in peanuts and you get in maize when it's not dried sufficiently and then stored and becomes very hot and the fungus grows and you get this aflatoxin that the fungus gives off. And you have periodic outbreaks of it where 30, 40 people in Kenya die from acute poisoning. But what you have more is low-grade, low-level consumption of aflatoxin, which can have major implications which are largely invisible. And simple things like better drying technology, better aeration and storage, and that type of thing, very simple types of technologies can help deal with that. One of the challenges is that, whether we like it or not, the poorest consumers in Africa and Asia aren't willing to pay a lot for food safety, right? They have extremely low incomes. We are willing to pay a lot more for food safety. And so that creates quite a challenge, ethical challenge, but practical challenge also for policymakers.
Okay. Anybody else?
I'll just say, historically, food safety was a major, or a lack of food safety was a major cause of death in the U.S. too. In the 19th century, one out of four or five children died before they were five, a horrifically high number. Leading cause of death was epidemic disease, but also very high up there was exposure to spoiled food. And so that's one reason Americans did embrace industrial food so passionately.
Well, and we're also going through a major tightening of food safety standards with the Food Safety Modernization Act, which is a federal law that's going to affect everyone who does any kind of food preparation or processing. And again, I'm not suggesting that that's an inappropriate thing. But what tends to happen is that these kinds of regulations are disproportionately costly to smaller entrepreneurs because they don't have the volume of output to absorb a lot of the costs, which are essentially fixed in being able to meet these standards. And I think there are ultimately ways to work through these sorts of issues. But it is a challenge for businesses to be able to respond to an ever-increasing burden of regulation.
Okay, thank you. And maybe with that, we can open it up to questions from the audience.
Now, you see, I have the microphone, which means I'm going to come around when you raise your hand. But let me throw the first question out from here, which is that, you know, Mike, when I listen to you or anybody else on the panel, I'm really struck by the fact that there's a whole raft of equity issues. I mean, we've heard around issues around water wars. We've heard, you know, the whole issue that much of what's going on in terms of food deserts inside cities and everything else is a real growing inequality between the haves and have-nots, where food and water and other resources really end up being kind of at the cutting edge of how we understand equity in the future. Anybody on the panel want to respond to that while I look for the first hand back here?
Well, I can start and then others can add in. So domestically, here in the United States, which is what I know best, this is a huge issue. And I think it starts with the fact that we, on average, we are used to spending a very small amount of our income on average for food in this country compared to most of the rest of the developed world, and certainly the developing world. And what that means is that all of our food policy, whether it's the calculations for food stamp benefits, whether it's the reimbursement rates for school lunch programs and school breakfast programs, are predicated on a cheap food supply. But a lot of the healthy foods, the things that public health nutritionists push that we should be consuming, like more fruits and vegetables, more whole grains through the supply chain and baked goods and other kinds of things, are more expensive. So there's a huge contradiction between trying to, on the one hand, promulgate a healthy diet, and on the other hand, a food system that is predicated and food policy that's predicated on a cheap food supply, and that differentially preferences things that can go into processed goods, commodity crops, and other kinds of things. So one of the things we haven't really grappled with very well in this country is the notion of a healthy diet being a right. Now, there's responsibilities that go with rights, for sure. But we've predicated all of our policy on one trend in our food supply when that trend is actually counter to people being able to consume a healthy diet. So on the one hand, we need to confront that. On the other hand, even in many areas where people have resources to get a healthier diet, it's very difficult to do because there's no grocery stores in their area. There's no place. The only places they have to go buy food is liquor stores and quality dairy and 7-Eleven type places, which occasionally are good. On the other hand, it's hard to buy a range of fruits and vegetables. It's hard to buy whole grain products. It's hard to buy lean cuts of meats, et cetera, in those types of stores. So we've got a lot of issues in this country to confront for all residents of the United States being able to consume a healthy diet if they so choose.
Thank you. I think there's a question in the audience.
This is for Dr. Hamm and maybe others. Dr. Hamm, when you were speaking of producing food in enclosed buildings, enclosed capsules in urban areas, and where they would be free from disease and exposure to pests and so on, an image came to me of the bubble boys, who were raised in such a, in enclosed areas where they became, their immune systems became compromised, they weren't exposed to outside diseases and so on, and had to remain there. Are there any downsides to, any dangers to that kind of production?
Well, you want to start with, you were the one that said yeah. No disease.
Yeah, I was actually the one who said that. But obviously, and Mike and I are very attuned to this. There is a lot of basic science that remains to be done about these in enclosed systems. Again, there is the beginning of experimentation with introducing pathogens, for example, into these closed systems. And some of the work that has been done, and I want to make it very clear, it's very limited, is that most of the pathogens we know today die in an environment in which there are only three wavelengths of light. Now, one can only imagine that there will be a pathogen that figures a way to morph itself into that world. And so, again, I think part of my own journey about all of this is that it is going to take constant innovation at all different scales of operation, using all sorts of different approaches, so that we truly have a diverse portfolio of ways in which we produce food and deliver it to the population. I think as humans, we would all like to find that silver bullet that if we could only just do it this way, everyone would be fed. I guess I'm old enough and seen enough to say it's not ever going to be like that. We've got to have diversity of scales, we've got to have diversity of approaches, and we've got to constantly be willing to experiment our way into the next round of needs that will inevitably confront us.
Others want to take that on, or I'll look for another hand out here. Oh.
Well, just briefly, there's the old adage, if it sounds too good to be true, it probably is. I think probably fits here.
This is, by the way, an exercise program for the Pillsbury Doughboy. I get to run around her up here.
I'm not sure who to ask this question, but you talked about sustainability, and I'd like to hear your comments about the use of fertilizers and pesticides and so on. I just returned from Cuba, and one of the efforts they have in their urban gardens now, it's not to produce the quantity anymore, but how to minimize the use of fossil fuels. So they're experimenting with ways to replace artificial fertilizers and so on for more natural ways.
Yes, I know that Mike can comment on this as well, but one of my interests is in the kind of the rapidly growing use of plant protection chemicals in horticultural production to feed African cities. And I think it's going to be a major problem. First of all, you have a regulatory vacuum. Okay, you might have some laws that regulate the kinds of chemicals that can be used, but there is essentially no enforcement of those laws. There's very little knowledge, no nuanced knowledge at all on the part of most of these farmers in the cities that we've studied, okay, mostly Zambia and Mozambique, about the downsides of the different chemicals. Although they tend to be scared a bit of all of them, even the ones that are actually fairly safe. And you're going to have very rapid growth in use. You're going to have rapid increase in demand for marketed fresh produce, and you're going to have, as farmer incomes increase, they're going to buy more pesticides as well in their production. And so, for example, if you look at the top 10 most used plant protection chemicals for these are small-scale tomato producers feeding Lusaka, six of them are either fatal if swallowed to humans, or highly toxic to bees, or highly toxic to aquatic organisms, or highly toxic to birds, okay? Six of them have one of those characteristics. And two of them are banned in the US and in Europe. And those two chemicals, we just from a survey found, are the most commonly used ones by farmers feeding Maputo in Mozambique. So yeah, this is an issue that maybe is not on many African policymakers' agenda right now, but as consumers get higher incomes and education and begin to tune into it, it's become a big issue, I think.
Yeah, just to add to that, if I could, the other domestically, so it's a very complicated question that you ask and a very good one, because what we're able to do in one part of the country or in one part of the world, we can't necessarily do in other parts as easily, because the climate is different, the humidity levels are different, the rainfall is different, and all these kinds of things. So in the U.S., if you kind of divide the country at the Mississippi River, east and west of the Mississippi, west of the Mississippi and move far west to California, relatively low humid environment. Why is the majority of the organic certified land west of the Mississippi? Well, first of all, there's more land over there. But secondly, most of the vast majority of the organic produce is grown in California. Well, it's a low humid environment on fairly sandy soil, so there's good drainage, so there's not a lot of water logging in the roots. And so there's relatively low pest pressure compared to east of the Mississippi, where you've got high humid environments, like in Michigan. You know, Michigan apples, every pest and pathogen there is goes after them. And so I remember hearing an organic apple grower in the Hudson Valley when I was at Rutgers speaking at a conference who grows apples organically. Now, how do you control fungi in apples in high humid environments? It's with copper sulfate sprays. Mm-hmm. And so you spray the copper sulfate. Well, then it rains, and the copper sulfate washes off, and the copper goes into the soil. Over time, you start to build copper levels in the soil, which can become toxic. So you've created a toxic condition. And his comment at this organic conference was that he wasn't sure whether it was, in fact, would be better to use very small amounts of conventional fungicides instead of the copper sulfate, that it might be better for the environment overall to do that. So I think the point is that what we should be doing over time is looking for best approaches that minimize the use of anything that's not internal to the system, recognizing that depending on the environments in which it exists, if we're going to grow food, we may need to use small amounts until we get better at doing things. The other piece of that is our high uses of the big three for fertility, NPK. Because what people often don't think about is phosphorus and potassium, Our potassium, our storage of potassium, I always get these backwards, but our levels of potassium, in fact, that we're mining, are not really sustainable. And phosphorus and potassium, many of those are in very heavily contested parts of the world. In other words, they're not safe for us to get it out in many cases, or they're antagonistic to the U.S., which is what I think about a lot is domestic food production. So that's the other piece of it is that our inputs, just from a soil fertility standpoint, we need to do a much better job of thinking about how do we cycle. I mean, the big elephant in the room is recycling human waste into farm systems. And the problem, of course, with taking urban waste and recycling it into rural farms is that we commingle all of our household things that we pour down the drain, which are often very toxic, along with the human waste, along with industrial waste, and we end up with a fairly toxic soup that we then recycle back to farms in some cases. And so figuring out how to separate all of that becomes a huge issue as well. So it's a great question, a very complicated question. As an academic, I could go on for hours, but I will stop now.
I'll stop you.
Thank you. Myself.
Okay, let me see a hand. Actually, let me move this way and and ask a question of Helen. When you look back historically, much of what we think of, I think, in terms of 19th century America is all of these little, I think what Robert Wiebe called island communities, and the idea that everything was pretty much sustainable within a certain circle of those. Naturally, national consumer culture broke that down. To what degree would you say that it's, you know, are we again possibly seeing kind of this idea of shouldn't we be getting back to some notion of island communities? Is that, in effect, what the local food movement is really about, looking historically?
Yeah, I think that's actually a great comparison. I think, you know, there's a lot of, as I started the talk, you know, there's a lot of romanticization of that idea. And, of course, one of the big problems is climate. You know, in other words, you know, if we all lived in California, and, you know, the conditions that we see now in California were indefinitely extensible, that would be great. But if you're living in places that have, you know, that don't have ideal conditions for agriculture, it becomes a very different scenario. That's where I think we look to technology optimistically as a way to extend growing seasons, to reduce miles. I think, I forget who it was, it might have been Mike, who made the great point about you eliminate your, you know, any carbon reduction that you're doing when you do something as simple as, you know, drive a little bit further to a farmer's market to get the produce. Or, for example, if you roast your carrots, you know, at 450 in the oven when you get home, you can also eliminate carbon savings. So, I mean, I think one of what I'm getting from the panel is that this is all extraordinarily complicated. It doesn't mean it's impossible. Quite the contrary, I'm actually quite hopeful after hearing, you know, some of these forward-looking panelists talking about, you know, possibilities for the future. But I think it's much more complicated than a simplistic understanding either of the past or the present would lead you to believe.
I would also want to ask, what about China? I mean, I've heard just about every continent talked about except for Antarctica, but what about China? What do we know about how China is solving this issue?
Well, I mean, I'm maybe the most international one, but I'm not an expert on China. What to say about China? I think, we've all seen the food safety scares that have happened there, and I have a feeling that those practices have been going on for quite some time, and they're mostly just coming to light now. These aren't necessarily new practices. They're just people are becoming aware of them. You know, China has seen the very rapid supermarketization, you know, that happened in the U.S. over a longer period of time, but much earlier. So, you know, I think that the people that are able, this gets into the equity issue, the people that are able to go to supermarkets and shop in supermarkets are in general, probably not all across the board, but getting better quality and better food safety assurances than those that don't have the incomes or the transportation or whatever to get into that more modern part of the food chain. But I'm not an expert on China. We all know it's changing extremely rapidly. Whether systems in Africa and developing Asia, and by that I mean the Burmas, the Vietnams, the Cambodias, are going to look much like China even in the next 20 or 30 years, I'm doubtful of. But some of those elements of change will be there.
So. Okay, other questions? Well, I'm coming around.
Okay. You all sound like you're very smart and very wise in these ways. Is there anybody in power or with money who is listening to you? You know, besides academia, is there anybody who has, you know what I mean, power and money? Is there anybody who's like shaking their head, yes, I hear you?
I think things are changing slowly, and I'm speaking as a sort of layperson in this regard, as, you know, I don't study the present formally, but I'm very interested in it. In 2008, Michael Pollan, who I mentioned in my talk, wrote a great piece, I think it was in the New York Times Magazine, called, Letter to the Farmer-in-Chief. It was addressed to the next president. It was right before the election. And it was basically a plea for sanity, which I think we're hearing here as well. You know, I think some things are changing slowly. For example, the organic garden on the White House lawn, you know, symbolically, that's quite important. I don't think we could have imagined that 20 years ago. I do see some things moving in hopeful directions. I'm not entirely hopeful, however.
Boy, that's a really tough question. In terms of how we have, the number of us who have been working at constructing the global university for Metro Ag, Metro Food, I think one of the lessons we learn is that it is about sponsoring hundreds, maybe even thousands of local experiments. It's about having people come together and really put their minds to the task of where can the innovation come from, so that people, planet, and profit really don't have to be trade-offs, that it isn't a zero-sum game. But that takes real innovation. That takes really rethinking the system. And I'm not sure that governments, broadly speaking, can do that. I'm also not sure multinational corporations are much into doing that, although there's being more done by some of the largest food firms in the globe than what I think they're often given credit for. Having known very personally the head of agriculture for Nestle, he really brought the idea of sustainable agriculture to Nestle, and they created a sustainable agriculture initiative platform that involves producer and science and industry work groups all over the world that are looking at how do we change big commercial systems, but also how do we take on systems of the near subsistence farmer in many places in the world, because we've got to attack it in all of those ways. I think the least effective way to go about this is to vilify this or that part of the food supply chain and say they're in effect evil and they're doing all sorts of evil things to all of us. I don't think anyone really intends to behave in an evil way. And as a matter of fact, I have this saying on my wall, and I look at it countless times a day, never attribute to malice what can be adequately explained by stupidity. And I think we think there's much more evil intentionality in all of this than what there really is. But it is a matter of being able to have a kind of open dialogue with each other in government, in business, in the universities, in the advocacy community. And to me, that has to be the way forward. And it has to be done project by project, place by place. Because, again, I don't see any silver bullets out there that if I found the richest person in the world and said, please do this, there isn't that kind of answer.
So I'd like to also respond and just give you two quick stories and examples. The answer is a cautious yes. And the question is it nibbling around the edges or is it going to make fundamental change? That remains to be seen. But one of the people in our center, Laura Gadaris, has been working in Washington through a grant we have from the Kellogg Foundation, and she's put together a network of six or seven nonprofit organizations that represent elected officials at various layers. So the National Association of Counties, the National Association of Regional Councils, the U.S. Council of Mayors, and an organization called the International City County Managers Association. And so we have periodic gatherings with these groups. And one of the things we found is that the staff in these entities in DC are all very passionately interested in this and are looking at ways to get things out to their constituencies. Laura recently with ICMA did a survey of 10,000 municipalities to look at their interest in using food system as a vehicle for development in their communities. And there's a surprising amount of interest there and engagement at this point. So that's a national example. The local example I'd give is state. Rich Pirog in our center, the senior associate director in our center, has an MOU for the center with our Department of Agriculture. And they co-lead a statewide network to create food hubs, which are basically entities that are developing to help aggregate small and medium scale farm product into enough bulk to volume to get it out to some of the retail sector and other kinds of things. And in the last year, there was $1 million of new state money that went into grants to five entities around the state that are creating food hubs in state grants. And there's probably going to be another million this year. So there are, you know, a million relative to budgets of billions is not that much money. But the point is that it's a million more than there was 2 years ago, 5 years ago, 10 years ago. And so there is an interest, I think, in a growing understanding by a lot of our political leaders. I won't say all, but I'll say a number of our political leaders that it is, as Chris said, it's not an either or, it's not a zero sum game, but in the words of Keith Craig, who used to be the director of Department of Ag until he recently moved over to be the director of DNR, said that our department needs to do both what we've always done with traditional commodity groups and commodity organizations and export agriculture and build the opportunities for these regional and local food system activities by our farmers.
Somewhat related to the last question and then very much related to a variety of comments by the panelists, but summarized by Chris Peterson when he's repeatedly said there is no silver bullet. A colleague of ours who's now retired and gone, Glenn Johnson, used to talk about economic development depends on four factors that are complementary: changes in technology, changes in institutions, changes in human capital, and changes in biophysical capital. And that if any one of those is missing, the impact of the other three on economic development or economic growth, whatever you want to define it as, will be less because of the absence of that. The discussion of the U.S. history was extremely interesting because we've entirely distorted in our minds the U.S. experience. There was deep government involvement in the development of the U.S., everything from the Homestead Act to the building of, quote, market roads, to the institutions related to food safety, to the farm credit system and the availability of credit, and I could go on and on. But we have built in our minds a notion that none of that ever happened. The entire dispute during the election over you didn't build that is in fact that argument. None of that ever happened. I did it on my own. And much of policy here and elsewhere has been dominated by the notion of all we have to do is stand back and let markets work. So when we ask the question, is anybody listening? I guess the follow-up to that for me is, do you see any growing awareness among policymakers that they need to be focusing on the four drivers of economic development?
Well, yeah, responding a bit to that and a bit to the earlier question too, a lot of times I tell students that, you know, your career is going to involve, to a large extent, finding new and different and interesting and innovative ways of saying the same thing. You know, there's a few basic ideas you need to get across to policymakers, especially in this case, and you just got to keep finding ways to say it. And the thing is, you don't need them to listen to you every single time. You need them to listen to you once, to have the dime drop once and get a few ideas, you know, and you can contribute to the many different changes and many different minds that are going on that are resulting in some of the things that Mike was talking about. In Africa, I guess I'll just talk about the institutional capital and human capital. You know, it's so true, the lack of institutional capacity in Africa means that all of the natural resources that you have there have been so terribly underexploited or exploited by foreigners and not to the benefit of the local population. So the institutional weakness is there has been tremendous, and lack of human capacity. You have some major efforts, kind of painfully slow in many ways, to develop, you know, African strategies for really investing in agriculture and investing in the kinds of policies that are needed. You have an emerging strategy supported by many governments, supported by the World Bank, and now more donors as well coming along to make real investments and changes in what we call tertiary ag education. To develop the kind of person that can deal with the types of transformations that I was talking about, and you're starting to see some public money going into that, and also some private money, the emergence of new universities, vocational schools, and this type of thing that are private. Is it an overwhelming response? No. Most encouragingly, I see some trend in U.S. Foreign policy circles to no longer believe that you just have to get the markets right to make things work, that there is a lot more involved. But, you know, it's going to take time for that pendulum to continue, if it started to swing back the other way, to continue going to where I think it needs to be. So.
Thinking about those four elements that you mentioned, and I do think Glenn was right on the money. The one that we have given scarce attention to all of our discussion this evening is human capital. And we talk about, we want to have a dramatic expansion in organic production. Well, organic production substitutes human capital for chemical capital, fertilizer capital, all sorts of technology. And the question fundamentally is, even if we said that was the preferred way to do it, do we have enough humans who want to go back to the farm? One of the most startling things that I learned in traveling around the world putting together the Global University was sitting in Nairobi and being told that the average age of a farmer in Kenya, a developing nation, is now 60 years of age. Why? Because they have sent all of the kids and the grandkids to the city, because that's where the gold is. and the human capital crisis in food production doesn't seem to get any play, or not nearly enough play. And I know you were looking for hope, and I just said, well, here's another place where
you know me better than that.
Yeah, but again, keeping all of those four things in alignment really is what true sustainability ultimately is about.
Okay, with that, again, please thank you for coming, and join me with one more round of applause for our panelists.